Todd, it's called the internet.
What?
It has been a remarkable week in Seattle, a city grappling with major growing pains as a result of our booming innovation economy. The controversial head tax has pitted the tech industry, city government, labor groups, and neighbors against each other as Seattle decides how to deal with its growing homelessness crisis in the middle of this giant technology boom. We talk about all that and more this week on GeekWire from GeekWire.com in Seattle. I'm editor Todd Bishop.
I'm civic innovation editor Monica Nicholsberg.
And I'm staff reporter Nat Levy.
All right, we have got a lot to talk about this week. Monica, you were in the midst of this head tax debate down at City Hall. You saw what happened. Nat, you've been covering a lot of the aftermath and the questions about what comes next, and we're going to get into that later on in the show. But before we jump into the discussion, let's hear some highlights from the discussion that's happened over the past 2 weeks.
Get up, get down, there's a housing movement in this town. Get up, get down.
And no Bezos Durkin deal.
No Bezos Durkin deal.
No head tax, no head tax, no head tax, no head tax, no head tax.
Amazon is a responsible developer that pays living wage wages and provides living wage jobs for the construction industry. They don't have a requirement to pay prevailing wage, but they do. They provide health insurance and retirement for iron workers on that project. All of these projects. They have provided more than 1 million man hours in the last year alone to provide family wage jobs for people in and around this community. Homelessness is an enormous issue. Not just an Amazon issue. It needs to have a regional approach that is fair and reasonable, something that this is not.
Big businesses like Amazon have many tactics to avoid paying their fair share of taxes. And I think we have to keep in mind that this is not a question of whether or not there is wealth in our city to fund a much bigger tax. It's a question of the priorities of the political establishment.
Please call the roll on the passage of the amended bill.
O'Brien.
Aye.
Sawant.
Aye.
Bagshaw.
Aye.
Gonzalez.
Aye.
Herbold.
Aye.
Johnson.
Aye.
Juarez.
Aye.
Mosqueda.
Aye.
President Harrell.
Aye.
9 in favor, none opposed.
All right, Monica, so frame this for us. What's gone on over the past 2 weeks as you've seen this play out in the tech community and in the broader community?
There's been a lot of passion on all sides, as you just heard. And that's what really strikes me about this is the thing we're talking about is, I think, as you've mentioned, so wonky and specific. It's this very specific tax over 5 years designed to raise revenue to fund affordable housing and homeless services. But it's become this bigger kind of existential crisis for Seattle about whose responsibility it is to mitigate growth and whether the city council has been a good steward of taxpayer money and whether the tech industry is going to be an ally in solving these challenges or an adversary.
And many people, of course, look to Amazon because it is the poster child for all of these things in terms of its growth. It is the company that's grown fastest and with the most impact on the community. Nat, you cover real estate. Just to put this in perspective, I mean, they've basically taken over entire neighborhoods in the city over the past 10 years.
Not even taken over, built. They've built entire neighborhoods from scratch, from parking lots, from nothing, and turned them into forests of skyscrapers.
And then you have residents of communities around the city who look around and see things that are troubling. People are on the streets at the same time that many people are working in these gleaming high-rises. It really is a study in contrast, and I think you saw it come out this week in the debate. How would you describe what happened from a visceral standpoint this past week?
A perfect storm. I think that, like you said, it just became so emblematic of all of these underlying tensions that Seattle's been dealing with for years, and the fact that it was so about Amazon is really, I think, why this became such a heated debate. And there are people who will say it wasn't about Amazon, but there are also all of Councilmember Kshama Sawant's supporters who carried signs that literally said, tax Amazon, tax Bezos. So there's no way to have this conversation without them. And they really kicked it up a notch when they basically threatened to slow their growth in Seattle if the tax passed.
It was really remarkable. And we should say, just to put this in context, the original tax would have levied about $20 million on Amazon a year. That was the proposal. And I think the challenge that a lot of these companies had with the whole concept of the tax was that it only kicked in at a certain amount of revenue in Seattle. So essentially, they felt like it was penalizing them for creating jobs, which seems to be counterproductive in their view. And under the revised proposal, the one that was actually passed, it was $11 million a year that Amazon will be taxed.
Approximately.
Right. Why is that such a big deal? I mean, this is a company that makes many orders of magnitude more than that in revenue. Why is it such a big deal?
That's the question that a lot of supporters of this tax are asking. When you compare that to Amazon's revenue, it's a drop in the bucket. And when you compare a drop in the bucket to people dying on the streets, how can anybody make the argument that that's not worth it? What I think people in the business community would say is exactly what you just mentioned, that it's penalizing job creators, and it's not so much about the money specifically that would be raised by this tax, but it's more about sending a message that Seattle's government is hostile to business and what that might mean for economic development in the future.
We're going to get into the implications of all this, what comes next, a little bit later on, but I was so struck by Amazon's statement. Maybe I'm just used to the carefully crafted political statements that companies tend to put out in situations like this, but the gloves are off.
I think it still was a carefully crafted political statement. It's just the statement was harsh.
So they said while they resumed construction of one of the buildings that they had frozen while this debate was taking place, which was viewed as a threat that they would no longer grow here, which seems to be very much what it was. They said, quote, "We remain very apprehensive about the future created by the council's hostile approach and rhetoric toward larger businesses, which forces us to question our growth here." And then later on, they say, "The revenue increase far outpaces the Seattle population." Then later on, they say, "The city does not have a revenue problem. It has a spending efficiency problem." What do you think this does to Amazon's relationship with Seattle, with its hometown? Like, where do we stand?
Yeah, wasn't there supposed to be a reset of that relationship?
Yeah.
Where did that go?
Yeah. Monica, you've covered this. I mean, apparently that meeting did not go very well or what? I don't know.
They are not speaking the same language. Amazon and the city government aren't communicating well, and I don't think that there's one person to blame for that. I think if you look at Amazon's history in Seattle, though, they have a history of not communicating very well.
Amazon does.
Right.
And does the city have any blame to take on that?
Well, I think it's interesting because the city has met with business leaders throughout this whole process, but Redfin CEO Glenn Kelman put out this really interesting blog post yesterday detailing his company's stance and his reactions to all of this. He said that Redfin had tried over the past year to email and call the city council many times to offer their perspective and never got any calls back. So we don't know exactly. I mean, it's an imperfect process, certainly, but I think that communication could have been better all around.
What kind of strikes me about this whole thing is, who's happy about this outcome? Amazon's not happy about this outcome. A lot of the council's probably not happy about this outcome because they got a much smaller version of what they want. I haven't seen too many issues in my time covering politics or city government or anything like that where, like, everyone comes out angrier than they came in. Everyone comes out looking worse than they did when they came in. Amazon looks like they're holding cities hostage. The city looks like it's bad for business. The tech community looks like it's unnecessarily asking for people to fix the homelessness problem without having to kick anything in on their own. So it just strikes me that this whole thing has made everybody mad. Is not going to solve the homelessness issue. I believe Monica reported on a study that said that they need just hundreds of millions of dollars more than they currently have to fix it. And we're just talking about homelessness right now. We're not even talking about affordable housing.
So what about that whole issue, like in terms of the spending and all that sort of thing? Is there any sign about how this is going to be used now that it's been raised?
A final spending plan hasn't been reached, but the funds are supposed to go toward building affordable housing for the most part, deeply affordable supportive housing, the remaining going toward homeless services and administrative costs. The byline budget hasn't been figured out yet. And to Nat's point, it is one of those compromises where it feels like nobody really got anything. But I think the council thinks it's the best they could do, and they're happy it's done. And I think
get it out of the way.
I think Mayor Durkin really wanted a compromise, and one was reached.
My big thing, and sometimes it helps me to think, okay, wait, where do we want to be in 5 years? And what does that look like? And how do we get there? And to me, the optimal outcome would be Amazon fully engaged on the challenges facing this city that it depends so heavily on. And one of those challenges is clearly homelessness. And they do a lot on that front, in terms of very specific tactical things, their work with Fair Start and Mary's Place. But I don't think Amazon has yet applied its full ingenuity to this problem. And I think that is one way for this to be solved. And I had a column, I ranted on the podcast a couple of weeks ago about this. And I think that that is one way to have a good outcome, is to have Amazon fully engaged. And no matter what you think of the tax and whether it's the right thing to do or not, I don't think it creates that kind of situation where everybody's working together. It just makes things more antagonistic. And I in that way, I'm disappointed with it.
Yeah, I think you said it well that, you know, it's not just about the tax. This is a whole bunch of things all coming together at once. And, you know, we've got everything going on with Amazon's growth in town, traffic, affordable housing, homelessness. And this head tax, as it's called, seems like kind of the flashpoint that is coming to represent all of these things together. And I'm curious, you know, if that is true, and if it's not really about the tax, are we just going to see the same thing happen the next time we have any sort of policy proposal about affordable housing, homelessness, whatever?
Monica, you mentioned Glenn Kelman, the Redfin CEO, in his blog post. It was really remarkable, and I think we can link to it from the show notes in the post on geekwire.com and wherever you're listening to this on the podcast or wherever else. But the thing that struck me was that his contention is we're actually arguing about the wrong thing. We shouldn't be arguing about taxing to pay for the battle against homelessness. We should be arguing about zoning and creating more affordable housing to give people more options to do that. And people in residential neighborhoods, currently, it's not in their interest to do that, because if you bring in more inventory, more housing inventory, then the home values of the people who own homes don't go up as quickly. And so you've kind of got the incumbent challenge there. You know, I'm letting my home value go up, and, you know, to hell with the rest of you is kind of like implicitly what the effect is.
And I got mine, and
yeah,
I don't care about anyone else.
And I don't know that that's on the radar of everybody, and just in terms of how much zoning changes could change things. And he really makes the case for that. And yeah. And as the CEO of Redfin, they are in a position to know. Obviously, they aren't disinterested on the topic. Obviously, they'd like a lot more homes to sell. But at the same time, I mean, it makes a ton of sense.
It's something that I think is getting lost in this debate. And it's as much as the head tax is politically challenging, upzoning is such a landmine, with some really, really impassioned homeowners and neighborhood groups who are not willing to let go of these classic Seattle neighborhoods that really define the city. But I think that Kelman made a good point in his blog post where he says it's hard for homeowners to support zoning changes. It might mean an apartment building puts your house in the shade, but the alternative is worse. A city where people resent the economic success of those who can afford to live here, where police officers and teachers can't live in the communities they serve, where traffic and long commutes are the norm because people have to move further and further away to afford housing.
Yeah. You know, I have in my neighborhood some of those apartments, and it's been really interesting to see the dynamic on the surrounding neighborhood, because there's no parking. And I feel the impact immediately. And so it's also a struggle, because I recognize out of principle how great it would be to have all this affordable housing around us. But we haven't created the infrastructure to support that, because a lot of these folks, because of our transportation system, are still driving. It's so complex. And in that way, I have a lot of sympathy for the people who are leading the city in that way. But I'm not convinced that the money that's been raised is going to even begin to address the problem, let alone come close to solving it. It's clearly not going to solve it.
Right, because even if they had raised the full funding of the 500 person ahead tax, they still would only be able to build that affordable housing in a in a small number of neighborhoods that are zoned for mixed use. I do think that the bigger, more pervasive problem is that 69% of residential plots in Seattle are single family plots. They're houses where one family can live instead of a building where 30 can live.
I love this conversation, the wonkiness of zoning and head taxes.
Says the real estate reporter.
I'm going to start talking about impact fees if you don't stop me really soon.
I'm going to mitigate that conversation because we're going to be right back on GeekWire. We're going to be talking about what's coming next, because what's fascinating now is, what is Amazon going to do? And the answer might surprise you in terms of whether that would be positive or negative for the city, because there actually could be a silver lining in all of this. We'll get into that right around the corner. You're listening to The Week in Geek, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to GeekWire. It's Todd Bishop with Monica Nicholsberg and Nat Levy. We are talking about the aftermath of the city of Seattle's decision to impose a head tax on large companies in Seattle. Monica, real quick, the specifics are, how much money are they going to raise a year through this?
They're going to raise close to $50 million. It fluctuates a little bit each year, and it would be a tax of $275 per employee per year on companies with more than $20 million in annual revenue.
Okay, perfect. So that's the details. The implications are that Amazon is not only threatening, but basically predicting that they're not going to be growing as much in Seattle, and maybe even implying that they could be pulling back on what they have here. Nat, you wrote a story about this. Essentially, Amazon has its current footprint in Seattle, which is upwards of 10 million square feet of office space.
With all of their future stuff, somewhere around 13.
Yeah, so that's the thing. So they occupy a lot of space now. People driving around may see all these buildings and think Amazon is everywhere. But frankly, you ain't seen nothing yet if they build out everything else that they've got. It's the Rainier Square office tower right downtown. It's another building called Block 18. And of course, they lease a lot of space as well. And the question is, what happens to that? They've already frozen development on Block 18 temporarily before restarting it. And now they're talking about subleasing the Rainier Square Tower, so they wouldn't occupy that. So obviously this is just all bad for Seattle, right? If Amazon stops growing?
Not totally. I would say that there's kind of a mixed opinion from the people I talk to. You can look at it one way. You never want to see your biggest employer saying, we're out of here, or we're as they specifically said, we're questioning our growth here. That can have a lot of negative impact on jobs. It can make you look bad in terms of others who might be thinking about coming here. But on the flip side, Amazon has grown so fast in this town over the last decade that it has really hurt a lot of other companies, not to mention the people who have had a hard time affording housing and have been stuck in traffic and all the other things that comes with the massive growth of a company here. So if, you know, I'm a smaller company and I've been trying to get my hands on one of those fancy new office buildings for years only to get shut out by Amazon and their piles of cash every time I turn around, I might be hoping that they'll slow down a little bit, because then maybe I can put my name up on a new skyscraper or something like that. If I'm trying to hire some people and I keep getting beat out because I can't offer the kinds of packages or pay that some of these bigger companies can offer, maybe I'm looking good there now. But on the other hand, Amazon is the draw for the city. So if they do pull back, maybe we're not seeing the same depth of talent that we're seeing right now for the companies, both big and small, to pull from.
So they bring the people here originally. They're looking around the world to recruit employees. They bring them to Seattle. They might work here at Amazon for two, three, four years. And then over time, they get poached by the startups or
go start their own business.
Or in a lot of cases, go work for Facebook or Google or Microsoft or Twitter or Salesforce or, you know, all of the more than 100 other companies that are here. And that's where I think a little bit of this falls apart, is that yes, there is a trickle-down impact on the startup community, and it might make it easier somewhat for them to hire. But you've seen such an explosion of everything else here that I think, frankly, Facebook and Google might benefit more than your average startup from Amazon not growing as fast.
There's way more depth now than there was in the Boeing days, if that's what you're saying.
Right. No signs about turning out the lights when Amazon leaves, because
right,
there's a lot more here. And what's fascinating in all this is cities around the country would kill for this problem. I mean, this is like the depth of the economy, all these dynamic, innovative companies being here. You know, this is what they would kill for. But what was interesting too. I keep going back to Glenn Kelman's post. I learned so much from it. His point was that the real issue here is not these high paying jobs with the head tax, the $275 a year. That makes companies question the entry level jobs, the service jobs, you know, the things that are actually going to get people out of homelessness or help them afford houses, you know, on the lower end of the economic spectrums. It's such a complex issue.
Yeah, that's an argument that's been made not just by Kelman, but the idea is that $275 a year per employee is a very small fraction of the salary of a software engineer, which might be $130,000 of the year. But it's a much higher percentage of the salary of somebody who works in the mailroom. But at the end of the day, it's a corporation's responsibility to make those decisions. It's the city government's responsibility to set a regulatory environment that is fair and that takes care of people who need help the most, or that's one theory of government. But I think that this particular issue about whether or not Amazon slows its growth in Seattle is one where people in the tech and business community are maybe a little out of step with the rest of Seattle. I think this Facebook comment that one of our colleagues posted in Slack is kind of telling. It says, Jeff Bezos has been forcing the rest of us to question Amazon's growth in Seattle for years. Glad we're on the same page finally.
Okay. Wait, okay, so break that apart for me. So in other words, people in the city might be saying, hey, we don't want Amazon growing here as quickly, and now Bezos is agreeing.
Yeah, that's basically the idea, because Amazon put out this statement that said this forces us to question our growth, and the idea is that welcome to that conversation. We're all questioning your growth. And it's not an isolated event that I've heard that. In my Uber ride on the way to the city council meeting, my driver said, I'd be happy if Amazon just completely left. I've lived in the city my whole life, and I'm, you know, devastated by what's happened over the past decade.
Nat, your story kind of headed in this direction, but I don't know if you've ever read this, but there's a great book called The World Without Us that basically looks at what would happen if humans suddenly disappeared. And I almost wonder, it would actually be a really fascinating story to talk about, just as a thought exercise, to talk with experts about what if over the course of 2 years, Amazon just said, you know what? HQ2 is now going to be HQ1, and there is going to be no more former HQ1. Goodbye, Seattle. I mean, and I don't think that's what's going to happen, but I think it would be interesting as an exercise.
I think an important element of this conversation, and every time I've had one of these conversations where one of my friends says, is Amazon leaving? Like, I have a friend who's looking at buying a house right now, and he was like, should I not buy it? Like, what if Amazon leaves and the economy collapses? And I always just come back to the talent. Seattle has so many talented engineers and talent in general in all kinds of fields that support the tech industry. And on a global scale, we're seeing these talent wars where, like, in a lot of cases, the number one priority for companies is access to talent, because that allows them to grow and to build their products. And I just don't see a future where Amazon or any other established tech company here decides that it's not worth it to continue to try to tap that talent pool.
Yeah, I'd have to agree. I think that you can talk about how anti-business a place is as much as you want, but if it has the people you're trying to hire to make the devices and the services and the software that you want to make, you're just going to, you know, close your mouth or maybe open it and shout about it, but just kind of deal with it so that you can get the people in that you need. If the talent wants to live here, then that's where they're going to be.
And there are a lot of reasons that people want to live in Seattle beyond just the jobs.
What do you think this does for the HQ2 discussion? It feels like it raises the stakes, because wherever Amazon picks for its second headquarters, I'm answering my own question here. Because wherever Amazon picks for a second, wherever Amazon picks for the second headquarters, it feels like that has a much better chance of becoming a center of gravity for the company now.
I think it raises the stakes, and I think it influences Amazon as it's making this decision, because they've had this horrible conflict with their hometown for years. I mean, the head tax is probably the most visual sign of it, but Amazon and Seattle have not seen eye to eye for a very long time. And you've got to think that the executives who are making a decision about where to locate next are asking those kinds of questions, like, how does your city feel about growth?
Well, and the thing is, Amazon and Jeff Bezos have been very clear. They see the benefit of going into urban areas, whereas you see companies like Microsoft basically creating cities unto themselves in the suburbs. I think Jeff Bezos sees it as altruistic that they've chosen instead to grow in a dense urban area where theoretically at least their employees can walk to work, and they say many of them do. What does it say about where companies should establish their headquarters?
I mean, I don't think there's a blueprint one way or the other, though Microsoft has just been able to kind of hang back and do their thing and not have to be a part of any of this, like, debate and discussion, anger, whatever you want to call it.
There's no head tax in Redmond.
No. They're just off building what they're building. I think it's a challenge to put a huge urban campus in the middle of a city, especially one that hasn't really dealt with that in the past. Seattle's always had its big employers have been out of town mostly.
Boeing and Renton and Everett and down south in basically
yeah, and you think in about like Weyerhaeuser and people like that. I mean, they're in the city now too, but if they're going somewhere with a stronger transit system and more ability to absorb those thousands and thousands of people than we've been able to here in Seattle, maybe it won't be as big of a deal. But I'm curious what this does to the HQ2 city governments. Like, you know, is the city of New York sitting there like, oh man, what did we get ourselves into now? Or are they thinking, yeah, we can handle this. These guys don't actually want that much.
To bring this back to the topic at hand, this is about addressing homelessness. I mean, that is what this debate is about. And clearly it has taken on larger meaning in terms of the relationship between the company and the city and its residents. What about the homelessness issue? I mean, like, where does this stand now? What does the head tax do?
So I think there are a few factors at play here. We've already talked about zoning, and the head tax does not address the single family zoning in Seattle. And we are seeing some upzones, especially around transit centers, but I think that's a huge part of this conversation. Another part is like fundamentally about how to deal with homelessness, whether you should push people to shelters and provide more of an immediate emergency response solution or a housing first solution. The original head tax was definitely more in the direction of a housing first solution, where the majority of the funds would go toward building these deeply affordable units. At the same time, all of our shelters are full. So there's a need for both, and we're getting funding for some of those things. There's been a lot of noise on the business side about the city council not spending the millions of dollars that it has already wisely. And I think that there's some validity to that. There was an audit that came out recently of King County's homelessness response, and it showed that a lack of coordination created a lot of inefficiency. So that's valid. The city council's claim that homelessness is a moving target and we're one of the fastest growing cities in the country and we need more money to deal with it is also a valid claim. And there was this really much talked about study that came out right as this head tax debate was unfolding that said that Seattle needs $400 million a year conservatively to deal with its homelessness crisis. So there are reasonable arguments on all sides. There are unreasonable arguments on all sides too. But as Nat said earlier, this sort of watered down version is a little bit, but it's not going to solve it.
Yeah, I mean, those are all great points. And what I'm curious about is just, you know, who's got the solution? No one has really figured this out yet. So it's insanely complex. You can't just really throw money at it. You have to have ideas of where to put the money. But on the other hand, you do need money to do your services. So, you know, if no one trusts the city to spend their money wisely, then it's going to be harder for them to get it. But on the same token, it sounds like they're well short of what they need and what they think they need in order to fight this problem that just gets worse all the time.
Right. And I think that's what has been so frustrating following this so closely is there's a lot of passion, which is a good thing, but so much of it is just naysaying. And while I don't necessarily agree with the city council or the tech industry, and I also think there are differing opinions in those two groups, the city council at least is providing a solution. It might not solve it, but an option. And so much of the outrage over this tax, I feel like, isn't solutions oriented. It's just no. And we've also said no to a state income tax and a municipal income tax. And maybe more money isn't the answer, but you got to provide an answer.
Right. And Amazon would point out that they've contributed, what, a total of $40 million to the Affordable Housing Fund from the city?
Through fees associated with their buildings.
Right. Right. And so I think that is one of their questions. It's like, okay, you got this money. What did you do with it? And show us the results of that. And so lots going on there. But ultimately, I still believe that, and maybe it sounds too kumbaya. But they've got to just like work together. You've got a company over there that has done some of the most amazing things in the world. You've got one of the most passionate city governments and engaged leadership at City Hall. I think there's got to be some way to get everybody together and come up with an actual idea that everybody likes. Well, at least most people like.
All the ingredients are definitely there, but everyone just keeps getting mad at each other.
That's the real tragedy here, is that this whole debate, it seems like, has just driven a bigger division between groups that could be working together for a solution.
Right. It's kind of just like everyone with reasonably similar ideas just yelling at each other and vociferously agreeing and then disagreeing on everything else and how to do it and then whining about the outcome.
All right. We will continue to cover this issue. It feels like it's only getting started, and there's going to be a lot more to come in the weeks ahead. Follow all of our news at geekwire.com. We will be right back on The Week in Geek with The Random Channel. You're listening to GeekWire. Welcome back. It is time once again for The Random Channel, that moment of the week where we talk about all the random items we were buzzing about behind the scenes at GeekWire this week. I got to say, I had a lot of fun on Tuesday night this week.
What did you do?
I went to the Fairmont Olympic Hotel. I put on a suit.
Fancy.
And I sat at the bar.
Sounds fun.
Sounds like a great Tuesday evening.
The reason I did that was that every spring in May, mid-May, Microsoft has something called the CEO Summit. They've been doing this since 1997. It is one of the most incredible gatherings of business executives in the world. It's maybe not on the level of Davos in terms of the numbers, but I sat in the lobby there at the Fairmont Olympic and I saw Bill Gates, Warren Buffett, Maria Bartiromo from Fox Business, Reid Hoffman, just an array. I saw the CEO of Kroger, the CEO of Geico. I had to look at their badges to figure out who they were. But the interesting thing is Microsoft is very secretive about this whole summit, so it kind of creates a little bit of a drama for a reporter trying to figure out who's there. They won't even say who's there. So I just went in and sat in the lobby and watched.
Did you see anything particularly interesting?
You know, it was interesting how Bill Gates was kind of working the room. You know, he's not the most social person in the world. And it's interesting to see him in that kind of dynamic with other high-powered CEOs. And, you know, what's interesting to me especially is Jeff Bezos was there, and he's a perennial attendee at this event. So he basically showed up right at, you know, 6:15 thereabouts and walked right in.
And some good stuff has come out of these events in the past, right? Some big news.
That's right. 2 years ago, Satya Nadella and Jeff Bezos were talking at this event, and they came up with the idea, or maybe Jeff Bezos pitched the idea of having Alexa and Cortana work together, the two voice assistants from these two
companies.
And
now they do, just this past week.
Right, which kind of underwhelming, and it's not yet publicly available, but it's...
You know, hey, it's the thought that counts.
Exactly. So anyway, that was my kind of celebrity spotting moment, and it was a lot of fun. You know, you put on a suit and nobody asks you any questions, and I think that's my rule for the week.
Good advice from Todd Bishop.
Yes, exactly.
That's why I wear a suit to work every day.
I know you two have been talking about something that I completely do not understand at all.
I don't really understand it either. So in our company's Slack feed and my Twitter feed, all my friends talking in our group chats, it's all about this Yanni Laurel thing. Monica, you're our resident youth.
I've been hearing about this for days.
What's going on here? What's going on? Well, I'm old.
I mean, aren't you
and
the same age?
I don't think so. Okay. Not in spirit, anyway.
So we all, unless your name is Todd Bishop or Nat Levy, remember the dress.
I do remember the dress.
Oh, yeah.
That's why
yeah.
I avoided this.
Golder blue
dress that just took the internet by storm because no one could agree whether it was white and gold or blue and black.
This is like the head tax all over again. No one can agree on anything.
It is. It is like that. Well, there are only two options here, though. And this is sort of the audio version. It's this audio clip, and I can only hear one thing. I feel very firmly.
Oh. You know, we're on the radio and the podcast, so we can play audio.
Yeah, let's play it. Are you ready?
This is the sound of me leaving the room right now.
Nat's been trying to avoid it, and I told him you can't just avoid cultural phenomena.
Because it takes up too much time. I don't want to deal with any more internet arguments. I have enough going on as it is.
Well, too bad, because you're dealing with one. Let's listen.
Laurel. Laurel.
What's the question?
What do you hear?
Laurel.
That's what I hear too, but apparently a lot of people hear Yanni.
What? Claire McGrain, podcast producer, hears Yanni? Like right now, you heard it say Yanni. Okay, what's the science behind this?
I think it has to do with the pitch. I think if you hear in lower pitches, you hear one thing, and higher, you hear something else.
Whoa.
But I don't think that's perfect because it's also been tried switching the frequencies, and some people, like, they just hear what they hear. I hear Laurel. I feel very firmly that it's Laurel.
Okay.
Should we play it again?
Yeah, one more time.
Sometimes it can change over time, which happened to me with the dress, too.
Does it depend on where you're sitting in relation to the audio source?
I have no idea.
Okay.
Listen.
Laurel. Laurel.
I mean, like, what? Why is this even a thing? It's only saying one thing.
I agree.
What do you hear, Nat?
What do you hear?
I hear that this is really dumb.
Come on, what do you hear?
What do you hear?
I hear Laurel.
Wait, so we're in agreement.
That matters for anything.
Except for our podcast producer who's not on mic right now.
You're hearing Yanni right now?
What's wrong with you?
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
Quick note from podcast producer Claire here. I actually found a video on Twitter of someone who had like somehow manipulated the audio. So he played the original audio and then two different versions that he had manipulated. So in theory, the first version said Laurel and the second version said Yanni. And I heard that. So when he had manipulated the audio, I could hear Laurel.
Wait, what are you even hearing? Is it Yanni or Yanni?
Yanni.
What?
Laurel. Whoa, I heard it as Laurel.
You heard it, Laurel?
Whoa.
It changed for her. On air, I love it.
Whoa, really? You heard it as Laurel?
Yeah, that was really bizarre. I don't know what's going on. I'm going to go think about my life.
All right, let's end it right there. So for Claire McGrain, Monica Nicholsberg, Nat Levy, I'm Todd Bishop. Thanks for listening to GeekWire. And whether you're Team Yanni or Team Laurel, we appreciate you listening. Talk to you next time.
Thanks for listening to The Week in Geek, GeekWire's weekly news podcast. Follow all of our coverage of tech and science news at geekwire.com and subscribe to our shows on iTunes, SoundCloud, or wherever you get your podcasts.